here's today's Bible Minute with Bible teacher John Monroe.
At the moment of salvation, this is the wonder of the gospel, we are declared righteous by God. The moment of my salvation, I was clothed with the righteousness of Jesus Christ. The writer of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 10, verse 17, that God remembers our sins no more. He remembers our sins no more because our sins are gone, buried in the depth of the sea. This is the gospel. This is the wonder of God's grace. And I'm forgiven. I'm free. I'm bound for heaven. I'm clothed with the righteousness of my Lord Jesus Christ.
To find out more about God's grace and salvation, come to backtothebible.org and click on Jesus Who. He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And welcome. It is so wonderful to have you with us on this chilly weekend in the Upper Midwest. Thanks for making Faith Radio part of your weekend. It is Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, and we're celebrating that on Monday. This hour, we're going to take a look at the legacy of Dr. King and how he made such a huge impact in the world of social justice. And we're going to be talking to an author who has really delved into that topic and the significance of what happened in Birmingham, Alabama, back in the 1960s. And we'll be chatting with him in just a moment. I know I'm going to look forward to this because I want to learn more about the legacy of Dr. King. I know somewhat about him, but there is so much more to learn. I think both in his role as a civil rights leader, but also as a pastor and as a man. And we'll be talking to an award-winning journalist who's written a book on that topic coming up here on the Faith Radio Network. We do receive emails here, and if you'd like to write to us, all you have to do is go to myfaithradio.com and click on the contact link for my page. And if you've got a question for us about marriage or parenting, child development, faith and culture, we'd love to hear from you. I received an email from Jeanette, who listens in South Dakota, and she says, "Dear Dr. Bill, a 10-year-old boy recently took his own life in our town. I have a very hard time understanding how a child that age could do something like that, and I can't imagine how I would talk to my own grade school children about this issue. Please help." Wow. Jeanette, that email just breaks my heart. You know, we hear a lot about teen suicide in our culture, and it has really increased in recent years, tragically, but it's very rare for younger children to take their own lives. And you are right. It is so difficult to comprehend how this could happen. And as a parent, you know, I've got a 10-year-old, 8-year-old, and a 6-year-old, and it's painful to even think about that. Now, I don't know the background to this story, but childhood suicide usually involves mental illness or some kind of very serious family dysfunction. And sometimes, tragically, abuse is involved. Now, that's not always the case, Jeanette. Some kids are simply born with a genetic predisposition to depression, which is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain. And so while we don't know all the details here, the best way to talk to your kids about this is to explain to them that sometimes kids feel so bad about what's happening in their life that they start believing that things will never get better. And they lose all hope in the future. And they are so sad that they feel like taking their life is the only answer. Now, I would also tell your kids how sad the story of this child's suicide made you feel and that you could not bear it if something like that ever happened to them. What I would do is I would assure your kids that they can always feel free to talk to you about anything in their lives, anything at all, no matter how sad or scary or embarrassing it is. They can always come to Mom and Dad and talk about it. Tell them that you will always love them and you'll always be there for them, no matter what they go through in life. And remind them of God's promise that He tells us He will never leave us or forsake us. And I think you can also add that this little 10-year-old boy, we don't know the background, we don't know his story, but we can be confident he's in the arms of Jesus right now, in a place where there is no more pain and no more suffering. So thank you for writing, Jeanette. Again, very painful, very difficult, but I think something that all of us need to be able to address, because unfortunately it does happen. Well, let's change course here and talk about a very different topic, which I found this interesting research this week on sleep and technology. And there's been several studies in the news just in the last few months on this. And if you are having trouble sleeping, one suggestion that some of the experts are making is get the technology out of your bedroom. Scientists at Harvard Medical School have found that using a smartphone, a tablet, or a laptop at bedtime may actually interfere with the quality of our sleep. Now, the reason is there are specific wavelengths of light that can suppress the hormone melatonin in our brain, and that is what really induces slumber. It makes us feel sleepy and want to go to sleep. And so the result is, with these different wavelengths of light from the technology, less sleep and less time for our bodies to recover. Now, regular sleep disturbances are associated with a whole bunch of different ailments, including obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, you bet. All of these things are tied in with lack of sleep. And modern technology isn't helping us. You know, you might hear that little ding from your email or your text message at night, and that can certainly interrupt your sleep. But staring at screens late at night may actually be more detrimental. That's according to the lead researcher, Charles Seisler, who's a professor of sleep medicine at Harvard. He says, it is our exposure to artificial light, particularly in the evening hours, that has dramatically changed the timing of our circadian rhythms. Dr. Seisler points out that energy-saving LED lights are actually the problem. They are used in everything now, flat panel TVs, computer displays, smartphone screens. And as you know, they're also replacing those less efficient incandescent light bulbs around the world. Well, he recommends setting a technology curfew and using yellow-based lighting in the evening that can be dimmed and switched off completely by 10:30. Dr. Seisler said it may be that gradually lowering the light could be more powerful than just shutting off the lights all at once. So, interesting research. You can find out more about it if you go to Bloomberg.com, enter sleep and light in the search engine. But I think it's a wake-up call, if I can use that term, for all of us, to get the tech out of our bedrooms and to turn off our computers and our smartphones earlier in the evening. And as he said, start, you know, dimming, using natural yellow light, and start dimming it later in the evening and preparing ourselves for sleep. That's, you think about back before we had electric lights, you know, when we were more of an agrarian society, we went to bed, the sun went down, it got dark. You know, folks could read by candlelight, maybe do some work by lantern, but they went to bed pretty early and they got up with the chickens. So we're messing ourselves up with this technology and this different wavelength of light. Well, it's 12 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer. Coming up next, we will delve into the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as we celebrate his birth this weekend. And we will talk to a man who's written a fascinating book about what happened with the Birmingham Revolution back in the 1960s. Stick with us.
The process of caring for aging parents can be a time that draws families closer together. Unfortunately, it usually becomes a time that tears them apart.
Dr. James Dobson for Family Talk.
Typically, the sister who lives nearby feels she is sacrificing her life to care for her aging parents. Her siblings who live far away critique how she handles the finances. The parents feel cared for, but not cared about. And jealous rivalries arise due directly to poor communication. Author Tim Stafford suggests that a family meeting can help bring everybody into the situation on an equal basis. While your parents are still healthy and strong, get all the people concerned, brothers and sisters, close friends, and the pastor, to sit down and talk about the years ahead. Talk about medical care, housing, finances, and anything else that's on anyone's mind. Ask questions like, Mom, what do you expect during the next 10 years? And Dad, what's the best way we as your children can make things easier for you right now? An honest, loving, open meeting like this can help assure that all friends and family members are working from the same set of assumptions and expectations. And it also sets a pattern. When a crisis does arise, calling another family meeting will be a more comfortable, established course of action.
Hear more at MyFamilyTalk.com. MyFamilyTalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And you can join the conversation by calling us at 877-93-FAITH. Why don't you write that number down? You can touch base with us anytime during our live programming at 877-93-FAITH. And, you know, if you call us this hour and give us your contact info, your name, address, phone number, email address, we will enter you into a drawing for this wonderful book, Birmingham Revolution, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Epic Challenge to the Church, written by this hour's guest. We have three copies to give away, and we will do that at the end of the hour. And the only way to get into the drawing is by calling us and giving us your contact info. So do that now, 877-93-FAITH. Well, joining us this hour is Edward Gilbert. He's an award-winning journalist. He serves as editor-at-large for Christianity Today magazine and as the executive director of communications for the Evangelical Covenant Church. He was the founding editor of Urban Ministry, Inc.'s online magazine, Urban Faith, and had a wonderful book, Reconciliation Blues, A Black Evangelical's Inside View of White Christianity. Today, he joins us to talk about his new book, Birmingham Revolution. And Ed, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thanks for having me here, Dr. Meyer. It's
a blessing to have you on. It's a very significant weekend in America as we celebrate the life of Dr. King. Let's back up a minute first, and I'd love to talk a little bit about your earlier book, because the title is fascinating, A Black Evangelical's Inside View of White Christianity, Reconciliation Blues. Give us a little overview of maybe your own experience in the evangelical church and in white Christianity.
Yeah, well, Reconciliation Blues was an attempt to create an opportunity for conversation around what can often be a very difficult topic of race, particularly race in the church. And I've spent most of my life in different situations where I've been the only African-American or one of a handful of people of color in a room in terms of my church community and places that I've worked and school situations as a kid growing up and in the 70s and 80s and getting bused across town to help integrate schools. So just over time, the issue of race has been very sort of central in my experience. And then as I grew in my faith and realized that these issues were actually an issue, you know, a problem in the church as well, I found my career sort of gravitating in that direction. So as a journalist with Christianity Today and other places, I've written a lot about that topic. But my main goal is to help people get the topic on the table, get the issues out there, to be able to say the uncomfortable stuff, the crazy and stupid stuff, without fear of you know, someone calling you a racist or saying that you don't get it. And that was what Reconciliation Blues was about, telling my story and the story of other African Americans and people of color in the evangelical Christian world, and helping them be honest about the situations, and then, you know, welcoming a conversation that could help us move forward and grow.
Let's talk a bit about your own story. You just touched on a couple of things there. You mentioned being bused across town. Where did you grow up, and what was your experience like as a child?
Yeah, I'm from Rockford, Illinois, you know, about 90 miles northwest of Chicago, and I grew up in that period where, you know, the school desegregation was sort of the major issue on the table. And I had no idea then, as I was being bussed out of my neighborhood and passing by all these other schools that looked perfectly fine to me, why I was going, you know, clear on the other side of town, the white side of town, where the homes looked a little nicer and things. And I found myself sort of living in a dual existence in some ways, you know, going there during the day and then coming back to my side of town. At the same time, you know, I took the school bus to school, but there's also a school bus that came into my neighborhood on a Sunday morning and picked up some kids in my neighborhood and took us to Sunday school at Memorial Baptist Church. And it was a predominantly white church, but I learned about the Lord there and came to faith. And even though, again, I was one of just a few people of color in the room, I saw God use that experience to draw me to Himself. And I'll always remember my first Sunday school teacher, Mr. Kaiser, who told me about Jesus. So I have this sort of complicated relationship with both race and faith. You know, they're connected. And I realized over time that, there's some folks who feel like we just need to ignore it and it will improve or go away or it won't be a problem. But just in my situations at work and church, I see the evidence that by not talking about things, sometimes we're ignoring our history that sort of shapes what's happening today. And we're missing out on, the beauty of the unity and diversity that God is calling us to. And I don't think colorblindness serves us well when we can see the beauty of God's creation expressed in just, the variety of races and cultures. But the idea is, how do we bring those together in a way where we can interact and express our unity? And that's part of what Reconciliation Blues was about, too, just sort of welcoming that conversation.
Wow, you just made a very powerful statement there, a couple of sentences that brought tears to my eyes, I have to be honest. I had an African-American psychologist on a month or two ago, and we were talking about the whole issue of what happens on Sunday morning in churches across America and how, unfortunately, it's still a very segregated hour, a couple of hours. Yeah. And we looked at some of she's actually a social psychologist, and looked at some of the reasons behind that maybe we don't even acknowledge just from a psychological perspective. It sounds like, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, it sounds like as you were growing up, that experience of being taken in the van or the church bus to that predominantly white church was, for the most part, a positive one. You learned about Jesus' love for you. Did you experience acceptance and love from the white members of that church?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But here's the thing, Dr. Meyer. In my experience, as I said, you know, sort of the two worlds existence, you know, there are times when, you know, I am the only, or I was the only black person in the room, and you know, I feel accepted, but then some things might be said that might be taken as a little insensitive regarding race. You know, a particular word might be spoken, and, you know, someone might apologize, and I'm sorry about that. But it's the those types of things, and I could be in a room, you know, with just African American people, and I can hear, you know, certain things spoken that might be, you know, not so kind toward toward the white community. And, you know, my experience has been, you know, I want to defend that person who's not in the room, and I want all of us to be aware of, you know, how those other communities might feel. That's why I really welcome honesty in how we interact with each other. And, you know, what I say among one group, I want to feel like I can say it among another group. And I think sometimes we're not aware of how we are some of the prejudices and the expressions of racial insensitivity that we're putting out there when, you know, others aren't around. That's why I think it's so important that we put ourselves in situations and we look for opportunities to interact with those who are different from us, whether it's different skin color, different cultures, you know, different ethnic backgrounds. It's so important because those the issues of what I think is more of an institutional racism can sort of slip into, you know, how we think and how we see the world and how we perceive other people if we don't have real authentic relationships with those people. And God, I think, has given me a gift of sort of floating, you know, between those different worlds. And I feel like part of my responsibility is to say, hey, you know, we need to treat others the same way that we'd treat them if they were here in this room with us right now. And we need to be honest about that. So that's another part of the, yeah, Reconciliation Blues. I want those conversations to happen. And I'm just convinced that if we don't have them, we're going to remain stuck in our sort of racial paralysis.
You know, your attitude is so refreshing. And I hear this acceptance and love in your voice. Have you always felt this way, or was there a time back in those tense days in Rockford where you felt a lot of anger at some of the, I'm assuming you experienced some out and out discrimination at times?
Oh, absolutely. I experienced anger, but it was almost, for me, it was almost more disappointment than anger. Or, you know, I think I grew up in with a certain level of naivete, just in terms of believing that, you know, everybody got along and that everybody was sort of seeing the world the way that I was seeing it. And at those moments when, you know, something would come out where, you know, like I said earlier, you know, a particular word is spoken or something said that's derogatory, you know, it was shocking, but it was also a reminder that, you know, this is a fallen world, and there are issues that, you know, we're still grappling with as a nation, as a church, as a world, that, you know, we have to approach with a certain level of honesty. And, you know, over time, growing up, you know, I came to see how those things work in, you know, on larger levels in our you know, institutions and in our economic system and the way it's expressed in the workplace and those things. And you know, those things make me angry too when I see those types of injustices. But I also realize that, you know, real relationships can help begin to turn the tide on those types of things. And it starts with conversations.
The research would indicate that racial prejudice is typically learned from one's parents, or in many cases, the family we grew up in. Our parents' attitudes towards another ethnic group influences us quite powerfully. In your own home, how did your parents view, and we've just got about 2 minutes before the break, so I'll ask you to answer this briefly, but how did your own parents view the white community?
We had a lot of good. I grew up with parents, African American parents. I was adopted, who were a little older, but who had really good relationships across racial lines. And from my dad's workplace, his coworkers, we'd go over to their house and different things. Now I can't lie and say that there weren't times when things were said in terms of you know, how the white people are treating us, or, you know, pointing out some unfortunate situation. I mean, that's we kept it real in that regard. But at the same time, I realize now how fortunate I was to grow up in a family where we had friendships across racial lines. So I always had a sense of the humanity of you know, people from the other side of that racial line, and I'm very thankful for that.
Well, I appreciate so much your perspective, Ed. We're talking to Edward Gilbreth. He is the author of the new book, Birmingham Revolution, as we celebrate the life of Martin Luther King Jr. on this weekend and coming up on Monday with parades and celebrations across this nation. We're going to dive into the life of Dr. King and what happened in Birmingham and that letter from the Birmingham jail in just a few moments here on the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
Here's what's ahead on the next Connecting Faith.
On the day we remember the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, we'll hear a firsthand account of life at the forefront of the civil rights movement in Birmingham, Alabama. Carolyn Maul McKinstry was in the 16th Street Baptist Church when it was bombed in 1963. She was hit by a fire hose in a civil rights march, and she's written about her account in the book While the World Watched. We'll get a fresh perspective on racial reconciliation on Monday's Connecting Faith.
Listen for Connecting Faith, weekdays at noon on Faith Radio.
Real encouragement for an active walk of faith. Podcast audio of today's programs on Faith Radio in case you missed the show. The very latest on conferences and events in your area. It's all in one place and delivered right to your inbox from Faith Radio when you subscribe by email to myfaithradio.com. Head to myfaithradio.com and enter your email address in the subscribe box right at the top of the page, helping you connect faith to life every day at myfaithradio.com. Conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. In the 20th century, compelled by the Spirit of God and a yearning for freedom, the African American Church took the lead in opposing racial injustice. Like almost no other movement before or since, Christian people gave force to a social mission, and remarkably, they did it largely through nonviolent actions. Those are the words from the back of Birmingham Revolution, Martin Luther King Jr.'s epic challenge to the church. The author is Ed Gilbreth. He's with Christianity Today, and he's also the author of an earlier book called Reconciliation Blues. Ed, I have to be honest, I don't know a whole lot about the early life of Dr. King and his role as a pastor, even prior to the civil rights movement. Can you give us a little biographical sketch of Dr. King?
Yeah, well, of course, Dr. King grew up in what would be considered a middle-class family in Atlanta, Georgia, and he was a very bright, precocious student who graduated from high school early and entered college at Morehouse and he was the son, grandson, and great-grandson, actually, of Baptist preachers. So his childhood was spent in the church and just surrounded by that sort of fundamentalist Baptist culture of the black community at that time. Came from a very socially aware family. His father was something of an activist as well, and always taught his children the importance of their own dignity and that they were people with worth that was equal to others despite the segregation and the racism that they saw around them. So he had a very good sense of who he was as a person growing up. And at the same time, you know, in college, he was trying to run away as far as he could from the whole calling to be a pastor. Had no desire to do that. Thought about being a lawyer and being a doctor at Morehouse. But over a period of time, that call sort of grabbed him, and he realized that what he was being called to do as a spokesperson for justice in the world could best be done and led in the black community through the role of the pastor, and just felt called back to his roots. He went on to attend schools up in the north, and a lot of folks will knock him for, you know, going to more liberal theological seminaries up there, but a thing to be remembered, too, is that there weren't that many conservative or evangelical Bible schools at the time that would accept an African-American. And he was also looking for something that could help describe and help him interpret the world that he saw around him, the segregation and the division, and how that could be reconciled with the Christian faith, as he saw many otherwise good white Christian people, church-going people, who were spewing racism and holding the line on the issue of segregation. It didn't make sense to him. So he was not only looking at the New Testament preachings of Jesus, but he was looking at the work of Gandhi and more liberal theologians to help put together a framework, a theological framework to interpret the world around him. And he developed this sense of intersection of both faith and justice, of nonviolence, of using passive resistance as a way of confronting injustice and confronting opponents, and a powerful statement. But at the heart of it, really, it came back to this was the teachings of Jesus, and he really believed that a full expression of the gospel also needed to speak to the issue of justice. That needed to be there. And didn't see that in some of the ways that the church was proclaiming the gospel a lot, but he felt it needed to be restored. Otherwise, the church just becomes an irrelevant social club, is what he said. So sort of a summary of his trajectory from Atlanta to his time as a civil rights activist. His first pastorate was at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. And, the history is well known. He was a newcomer to town, and a boycott was underway when Rosa Parks refused to relinquish her seat on the bus there, and began this movement, and they needed a leader. King was new to town, didn't have many enemies yet, and didn't have much to lose, and they convinced him to take that role, and found that he was the powerful, articulate spokesperson that they needed. And I hate to use the cliche, but the rest is history. But that's what the book is about, the history.
When you say they, who approached him? Was it other pastors? Was it those that were in the burgeoning civil rights movement in Birmingham? Was it national leaders that said, Dr. King, you're the guy? And did he accept that call immediately, or was he somewhat reluctant?
Oh, yeah. It was a combination. I guess one of the things that should be noted is that the civil rights movement, of course, was a church grounded movement, but it was also made up of folks who were a part of the NAACP and other sort of local activist groups. But pastoral leaders in the area and other civic leaders reached out to him, and he was a bit reluctant at first, but also was aware of his call and the reason he went back to the South in the first place. He met his wife Coretta up in Boston and married her there when he was attending Boston University for his doctorate. But she wanted to stay in the North. She had had enough. She was originally from Alabama and had had enough with the segregation there and didn't want to raise a family under those conditions. But King, after much prayer, said, "We have to go back." So he knew that he was in the South. He had to return home for this very reason, that he wanted to be a voice for speaking up for justice and for change, but didn't quite know how that was supposed to look. And I think in Montgomery, as the boycott emerged and as people were reaching out to him, I think he was putting the pieces together. the famous story, though, is that there were times early in the boycott where he had major doubts and at times thought about quitting. It got real intense, and as the black community refused to use public transportation, they were persecuted at different points and received different threats. And King, one evening, January 1956, received a phone call from a very threatening white segregationist who spewed some hateful words and told him that he would blow up his house and called him the N-word and all these types of things and to watch himself. And King hung up the phone. It's, you know, past midnight. He's pacing in the kitchen, pours himself a cup of coffee to just try to stay awake and think, and just has sort of a collapse right there cries out to God, you know, I don't think I can do this. This is too much. You know, my family is here, and this is too much, God. I take this almost in the Gethsemane garden sort of moment. And he remembers that at that moment, a gentle voice that he took as the voice of God, the voice of Jesus, spoke to him and said, you know, you will go, Martin Luther, you go, and I'm with you, and I will walk with you and carry you through this. And it was like this transformative moment in his journey where he realized what his call was, and there was really no turning back from there. There were a few, you know, stutter steps along the way, just trying to figure out the strategies. But at that point, he knew that this was his call to be a prophetic voice for justice.
Now, it's interesting. You mentioned that Coretta had grown up in the South, had experienced the full brunt of segregation and prejudice, and wanted to be in the North, in Boston, where there was not nearly the sort of certainly not the segregation and the prejudice that you'd see in some place like Birmingham. When he was approached by these leaders and asked to be the figurehead, to be the guy, how did Coretta respond?
Yeah, Coretta was a very, I think once the decision was made to return to the South, she was very supportive. I don't want to say she was a submissive presence, but she was perhaps, you know, his greatest encourager. She was a very strong-minded woman who, refused to have the vows at their wedding include, the obey your husband stuff. And so she had her own ideas and thoughts, and I think that's something that drew King to her. He was attracted to her strength of character and that. So he respected her opinion and relied on her as a confidant and support in different things. So she knew that this was their calling, and I think once she agreed to marry him, she sort of released that to God in terms of this is our life, this is what you're calling us to.
Did they have children at the time when he took the mantle of leadership in Birmingham?
Yes, their first child, Yolanda, was born at that time, and she was just a new little baby, and that was part of the stress and frustration that King was feeling during that time with his new daughter and the threat of bombs and things against his family. It was just too much for him to comprehend at that point.
I as a dad with three kids myself, just, you know, being asked to take on that role when I knew, I mean, that call from that white segregationist at midnight saying, I'm going to blow up your house, there'd be part of me that just would want to say, I'm heading back to Boston. Get me out of here. You know, I've got a wife and a child, and what a tremendous, first of all, amount of courage that Dr. King had, but then his faith in God and believing that that voice of the Lord was saying, this is what I want you to do, and I'm going to take care of you one way or the other. That had to be, and I don't know if he wrote on that topic of the fear for his own family, but that had to be at least in the back of his mind when he made that decision.
Oh yeah, yeah, and he did write about it, and he was definitely, that was his concern. But you know, as time went on, I think he, you know, at an early stage became sort of aware of his own destiny in some ways. And in fact, there's a moment where he and Coretta are watching the news that President Kennedy had been shot, and later that he died. And you know, he said to Coretta at that point, just sort of offhandedly, you know, that's what's going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. This was 1963, like 5 years before. So I think once he was on that track, he had a sort of a sense of, you know, this is probably not going to end well for me based on the circumstances in our nation and the violence at that point and just the hatred that was going around. Yet he had the courage, the God-inspired courage to continue. But it was definitely at a cost, and he knew that.
Mm. Wow. Powerful stuff. We're talking to Ed Gilbreth. He is the author of Birmingham Revolution, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Epic Challenge to the Church, a book that I would highly recommend to you, especially as we celebrate the life and the legacy of Dr. King this weekend. It's 11:46, and you are listening to the Faith Radio Network. We do have 3 copies of Ed's book to give away. If you want to give us a call and give us your contact info, we would be happy to put you into that drawing. You can call us at 877-93-FAITH. And at the end of the hour, we'll be giving away 3 copies of Birmingham Revolution. I'm Bill Meyer, and we'll take a quick break and be back with the final segment with author Ed Gilbreth after this.
Hi, this is Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. It's the start of a new year, and I hope one of the New Year's resolutions that you've made this year is to support Faith Radio. Your prayerful, generous support is changing lives across the Upper Midwest. You can give simply and safely online at myfaithradio.com or call 877-933-2484 to make your gift today.
Helping you grow deeper in your faith.
Marriage is meant to make you more like Christ, but it's also supposed to be fun. Laughter is an important part of the recipe. This is Susie Larson, and on the next Live the Promise, I'm excited to talk with Pastor Ted Cunningham. He'll offer tips for bringing the fun back into your marriage and learn to enjoy life with your spouse.
Live the Promise with Susie Larson, weekdays from 3 to 4 on Faith Radio.
You can help make people rich, and it has nothing to do with money. Northwestern's Adult Bachelor of Science degree in health psychology with a concentration in applied behavioral analysis can get you on your way. You'll learn how to promote health in people of all ages, focusing on behaviors that contribute to wellness and building lives that are truly rich. For more on this brand new online accelerated program, visit unwsp.edu. University of Northwestern, St. Paul. Learn, lead, invest, impact.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back as we celebrate Martin Luther King Day on Monday across America. We are talking to Ed Gilbreth, the author of a brand new book from University Press called Birmingham Revolution, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Epic Challenge to the Church. Ed, before we dive back into the book, something happened to you a couple of years ago in Atlanta. You're a guy that grew up in Rockford, Illinois. You experienced certainly some degree of segregation in that area, but something happened to you in Atlanta which gave you a whole new perspective on racial prejudice. Oh, yeah. Tell us what occurred.
Well, it was, I must confess, I was sort of hypersensitive at the time because I was doing research for the book. I was down in Atlanta, and then I had planned a trip over to Birmingham. But I love used bookstores, and so I was in a rental car, a little red rental car in Atlanta, trying to find a used bookstore that I had looked up on the internet before going on to an event at Morehouse College later that night. And I got a little turned around in an unfamiliar section of the town and got lost. Couldn't find the place and decided that I'd better head back. And as I'm sitting at the light waiting to turn onto the road that would connect me eventually with the expressway, I see this policeman sitting directly across from me. And I say, okay, I better be on my best behavior here. I don't want to get caught while I'm out of town here doing anything I shouldn't be doing. And as the light changes, I take a left-hand turn, and suddenly the cop darts out behind me and turns his lights on, and I'm wondering, what did I do? I'm being very careful here, and I see him. I know he saw that I saw him, and anyway, he pulls me over into a vacant lot, and after a few very tense minutes, walks out the car and comes to me and says, I made an illegal left-hand turn back there. And, I explained to him that I'm from out of town and I didn't see a sign and I apologize. I'm a little turned around and lost in this area. And part of me just sensed that, he might give me a break since I was from out of town and in a rental car. But he went to his car and came back and, gave me a ticket. But the thing that sort of bothered me a little bit was just his tone toward me. It seemed very, harsh, more harsh than necessary. And the fact that he was a very large white man. And here I am in the South in Atlanta, thinking about these issues from back in the 50s and 60s of, the racial injustices and how the law was very much against the black community then. I was sort of hypersensitive to things and took the ticket and he was just very cold. I got no sort of sense of, warmth for him at all. I went to Birmingham the next day, very afraid, driving very cautiously, not wanting to, tick any other cops off in the area. Did what I needed to do there, but on my way back to Atlanta, gassing the car up at a gas station, I saw an African-American cop. And I thought for a moment, should I ask him something? And thought, no, but then decided, why not? And I went up to him and I said, officer, I'm sorry, can I ask you a question? I was pulled over because of an illegal left-hand turn. I'm from out of town. I didn't see the sign. And, is there just a hard line rule that, there's no mercy on things like that? Or he said, no, usually it would be up to the officer's discretion, especially if nobody was hurt or anything. And I explained my situation and how that happened. And he said, in that case, I probably would have just given you a warning and let it go. But maybe he didn't believe you. And, I just sort of said to him, how serious. Well, I wish you would have been the cop that day. And so it was just an experience that, I apparently did make an illegal left-hand turn. So I'm not saying I was right, or that he shouldn't have given me a citation, but it just felt off about it. It felt wrong, and I realized in some ways it gave me maybe it was God giving me just a little taste of what it could have felt like in the South back in the era of 1963 in Birmingham that I was writing about. Just the sense that that the law is against you and that there's nothing you can do and that there's no recognition of your humanity, no sense of offering grace or mercy, that you were on unequal ground and that was it. But that recognition is more about just having empathy with the people that I was writing about. Not so much my situation, but I used it as just a way to get into the events that I was documenting.
Well, it's certainly a good window into the world for those of us who have never experienced that. a world of what it might be like to be an African American in the Deep South, whether that was 40 years ago or even in some communities even today. Ed, we've just got about 4 or 5 minutes left, and I know we've just barely scratched the surface of your book, but let's talk about the letter from the Birmingham jail. What did Dr. King say, and what happened then?
Yeah, the letter, of course, grew out of King's period, over a week in jail there in Birmingham. Birmingham, 1963, one of the strongholds of segregation during that period, known, you know, across the South as just being this vicious place. And King received the call to go there, was a little reluctant at first because he had a setback a year before in Albany, Georgia, didn't think that going to Birmingham at that point was a good idea just because of the intensity of the situation there. But eventually decided to go and realized after a few days of a faltering campaign that he needed to go to jail to make a statement. And he marched against a public injunction and was promptly arrested, thrown into solitary confinement. And while there, was given a copy of a newspaper article written by a group of local clergymen, 8 white clergymen, who actually were in favor of civil rights but felt that Dr. King's presence in the city was a disruption and could lead to problems and that the black community should just be patient and wait for things to change more naturally. King was incensed when he read this and in his cell and eventually quickly began to scribble on the margins of that newspaper a response to these clergymen and ran out of paper there and found whatever scraps he could. It said that he grabbed some toilet paper and was writing on that. And out of this came the letter from Birmingham Jail, which expressed in eloquent terms the reasons why the black community could not wait. Justice delayed is justice denied, and why injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and why that required King to follow the call to come to town. He drew from his photographic memory of folks like Socrates and St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine, Frederick Douglass, Thomas Jefferson. I mean, just putting together a comprehensive statement on both political theory and issues of justice, just and unjust laws, but also sort of a theological framework for why justice is a central component to an expression of the Christian gospel. And he drew from autobiographical sources, just sharing about his own pain of not being able to take his daughter to a local amusement park because, and explaining to her why, you know, black people aren't allowed there. I mean, it's just an incredible, powerful statement that grew out of his righteous indignation at that moment in the jail cell. But I believe it is a sort of, if you really want to understand King, this is the document to read. I Have a Dream, of course, is his most famous speech and the piece that everyone will mention first, but I think that should also, Letter from Birmingham Jail should also be a part of just the examination of who King was as a Christian and as a person, a champion for justice.
Mm. Ed, thank you so much for your time today. I want to recommend this book to our listeners. Once again, it's called Birmingham Revolution, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Epic Challenge to the Church. It's all about Dr. King's prophetic voice in the civil rights movement. And Ed, thank you for your time today. May God continue to guide you and direct you in your work as a journalist and your ministry.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer.
Ed Gilbreth, our guest today here on the Faith Radio Network. You have a wonderful weekend, and we will be back next Saturday at 11 a.m. here on Faith Radio.